Recently, I sat down with John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network to discuss his organization and what it does. Topics as wide-ranging as state subsidies of corporations and the role of the OECD as a think tank dominated by the rich countries were discussed. We got into some of the major work by the organization, including the price of offshore, the Financial Secrecy Index, international accounting standards, and more recently, automatic information sharing. I learned a lot, including that if I want to set up a shady company, which I want no record, I didn't have to go far. Wyoming is apparently a booming secrecy jurisdiction, part of the new American Wild West. All in all, the interview is about an hour in length. Sorry for the bad sound quality. Hadn't quite got the settings right.
So I'm talking today with John Christensen. I think you're the director, right?
That's right. Director of the Tax Justice Network.
The director of the Tax Justice Network and... about his work that he does with this group that a British friend of mine has said just he doesn't know what they do, but they always exist in the background. So we'll try to find out what it is that you guys do. So can you tell us when the Tax Justice Network was founded and about what you, I guess, were doing at this point and just provide us a little bit of context?
Sure. Strictly, the Tax Justice Network was launched in March 2003. It was launched here in Britain, but it was from the start an international organization. There were many people from many different countries, particularly European countries, involved in the launch. The launch followed a meeting in Florence in October, or maybe November 2002, Florence, Italy, where a group of professionals, researchers, and activists got together at the European Social Forum to discuss the whole issue of tax havens, tax evasion, and tax avoidance, and the role of tax in development processes. And at that meeting, we agreed to form the Tax Justice Network, which was simply a network of interested people, both researchers and activists. My own background in this is that I am an economist, an investigating economist, and I've spent almost the entire past 35 years looking at tax havens and their role in the globalized economy.
But you yourself were working for, I believe, an investment bank in Jersey, right?
Right. Well, first of all, let me say I am a Jerseyman. I grew up in Jersey, and I worked in Jersey. Yes, I did work in offshore finance, not in an investment bank. I worked for one of the big accounting firms in their trust and company administration division. The company was Deloitte. Now it's now called Deloitte Touche. At that stage, it was called Touche Ross. Let me add that I'm not a poacher turned gamekeeper. I went back to Jersey in 1985, 1986, to investigate how tax havens operate. I had previously been working with an organization called Oxfam, and there was a small group within Oxfam who were particularly interested in capital flight, tax evasion, tax avoidance, embezzlement, corruption, and its impact on development processes. I was part of that group, which met at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London in the late 1970s. So for me, going back to Jersey in 1985, 1986 and working there, and I worked there for many years, was a very useful way of investigating how tax havens operate.
And you tried to convince the Jersey government to diversify the economy and to support things like tourism more as opposed to just banking, finance.
Well, the top line, literally the top line of my job description, because after leaving Touche Ross, I was headhunted whilst at Touche Ross to join the government's economic advisor's office and later head of that office. The top line of my job description read something along the lines of to maintain a balanced and diversified economy. And since the economy included a fairly large tourism sector, light manufacturing, agriculture, horticulture, as well as offshore finance, I spent quite a lot of my time warning the government that their policies, which were very heavily favouring the rapid growth of offshore banking and offshore financial services, were harming the other sectors. The inflationary impacts, particularly in the labour market and housing markets, were crowding out the other sectors. So I saw this as part of my job to protect those sectors from the inflationary pressures of hosting an offshore financial centre.
Did they listen?
No, emphatically not. No, I regrettably, their attitude was very much one of, you know, it was a kind of corporate attitude, profit maximization. They would talk in terms of Jersey PLC. They'd say offshore finance is the quickest and easiest way of maximizing the economic growth, and by and large, they weren't interested in the other sectors.
Sounds like they were reading Greg Mankiw.
Yeah, exactly.
that's maybe not a good sign. So, switching gears, an innocent bystander would ask you, what the hell is tax justice, and why is it important in the first place?
I suppose tax justice is a challenge. For many of us, when we created the Tax Justice Network, we were looking at a broader, much broader issue to do with economic justice and to do with economic sustainability. And we saw tax as playing a very important role in both. But the general discourse of the last 40 years has excluded tax. Tax has been presented as a very bad thing. And the general drift politically has been to lower taxes, particularly taxes on capital, and by stealth to increase taxes on indirect taxes and taxes on labour, which have had a massive impact on not only employment creation, but also on wealth distribution over the last 40 years. So we wanted to put issues like inequality, environmental degradation, social sustainability, and so on, onto the agenda, arguing that tax plays a very, very important part in shaping development outcomes. If we were serious about wanting to overcome too much reliance on hydrocarbons, we'd have introduced a carbon tax globally 30 years ago. So that was one of the issues we wanted to tax, but to tackle. But we began by looking at tax havens because, in many respects, this was an easy way of drawing attention to the way in which tax regimes have been politically shaped by, frankly, political laziness and the lack of political will to rewrite the rules to put an end to tax havens. So that was our first line of attack. And our line of attack was to look at the rule maker, which is the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development countries, and target them as being responsible for the way that the rules for taxing multinational companies in a world of globalized finance are completely unfit for purpose.
And they've, I guess, since responded to some of your work. I've heard cited on numerous occasions by OECD, functionaries. Of course, famously in 2012 at this meeting.
Yeah, I mean, it's true that they have responded. Initially, their response was pretty dismissive, or rather. Publicly, the response was fairly dismissive. They tended to talk in terms, when we highlighted tax avoidance and tax evasion, they'd talk about the few bad apples. But I think that the publicity given to the top-end case studies, the Google, the Amazon, the Apple, and so on, those case studies convinced a very large proportion of the public that there is a systemic issue, and the OECD was forced to respond. At the same time, we've been working very hard with our colleagues in Africa, Latin America, and Asia to argue that the OECD's processes for information exchange between countries were not only weak and inadequate, but were almost purposefully weak and inadequate. In other words, were crafted to be ineffective, and therefore we've put a lot of campaigning pressure on the OECD to strengthen its game by moving away from tax information exchange agreements based on their on-request model towards a global multilateral automatic information exchange process. We've been successful there. Just 3 years ago, the OECD, or senior OECD officials, told me that automatic information exchange was unlikely to happen within at least the next decade. The following year, G20 instructed OECD to go ahead and start preparing the global protocols for making automatic information exchange the global standard. So we've had success there. And we've also had success, and I think this has been because the public have been very supportive, in demanding that multinational companies are much more transparent in their accounting processes. And here we came forward with a very specific demand, which is an international financial reporting standard for country-by-country reporting. And that seems to have attracted a great deal of support from the public, from development NGOs, and also from some politicians. So I think a part of our success lies in the fact that whilst we are very critical indeed of the current global order, we do come forward with some very specific and carefully crafted policy measures which the public can understand.
So what exactly are international accountancy standards, and how would they differ from what exists today?
Right. Well, at the high level, that we need to, all societies need to have international accounting standards, because we're dealing now in a global economy where fewer than 500 companies dominate, not just world trade, but dominate the economy. And investors need to have accounting standards to be assured that they can understand the information presented to them by the large companies, but also tax authorities, journalists, and other parties need to have, including civil society, need to have accounting standards which enable them to understand what companies are doing in their countries. And this is where we enter into kind of slightly Alice in Wonderland, because international accounting standards, most people would reasonably have thought, were standards prepared and agreed by governments.
Sure. Well, we have the International Accounting Standards Board. Isn't that what they do, someone might say?
Yes, but the International Accounting Standards Board is a private company, and they set the standards, which by and large are taken into European Union law and taken further, because many countries around the world automatically adopt the European Union's financial reporting standards, which are in almost their entirety devised by the International Accounting Standards Board, a company. And a company which is extremely untransparent in its own operations, based in Delaware, or rather registered in Delaware, based in London. Exactly. It is a slightly Alice in Wonderland world we're talking about here, and largely dominated by multinational companies and their accounting firms. So this is not in any way an intergovernmental body setting the rules. And we have been very concerned about the general drift over the last 30 years towards a less transparent and less user-friendly accounting systems.
And what has been the reception of that work?
I think
you mentioned it a little bit.
I think initially there was one of dismissal. In other words, you will never have an international financial reporting standard for country by country reporting. The initial dismissal has shifted towards one of consent, unwilling consent, but nonetheless consent. There's been some success in the United States where the Dodd-Frank's bill includes a form of country by country, project by project accounting standard applicable to the extractive sectors. And the European Union is moving forward with its own transparency bill, which includes a country by country provision. But there's a real danger that intense lobbying will lead to a very watered down version of what we consider to be a proper country by country reporting standard, particularly around the reporting on tax. I think the jury's still out on whether we'll see any major successes or whether what we'll see is a provision which is so weak as to be, to all intents and purposes, ineffective.
That seems to be the general symptom at present, this problem of watered-down policies.
Yep.
That themselves don't get passed because of the sort of information deficit, if you will. But I guess we'll keep our fingers crossed.
We monitor. We, that is Tax Justice Network, have a specific responsibility for monitoring what's going on the automatic information exchange side. And as with all networks, we tend to share the work with partner organizations. On the country-by-country reporting side, there is a constant monitoring and advocacy being done both at Brussels and at the OECD level. So rather than relying just on keeping our fingers crossed, we are carefully monitoring. We are intervening where we think that there's a watering down process going on. One of the advantages we have is that because we are seen as an expert-led network, we tend to be the go-to organization for journalists wanting to cover these stories. So if the G20 claims to have succeeded on one policy measure or another, journalists will be looking to us to comment on whether they have genuinely succeeded or whether they've actually come up with something of a window dressing exercise.
Sure. And actually, in that regard, I had a question I was going to save for later, but I'll go ahead and ask it now. I was going to ask about your TJN's run-in with Pascal Saint-Amand. Mm-hmm. This is the fellow that reported that developing countries have no desire for automatic information sharing. And can you just talk about who he is and what the Tax Justice Network produced in response to this assertion?
Right. Let me begin by saying that I've known Pascal for many years, for over a decade, and I knew his predecessor, a guy called Jeffrey Owens, long before then. So I've known both Jeffrey Owens and Pascal Saint-Amand for a very long period, for coming on for 15 years in the case of Jeffrey Owens. Pascal heads the Tax Affairs Department of the OECD, in other words, the organization that sets the rules in this area. Jeffrey Owens was his predecessor. Just as a little bit of a preface, let me just hang up a question, which is, who is the OECD and why do they set the rules? They're not a properly constituted intergovernmental body involving all governments around the world. They are actually a think tank based in Paris representing only the richest 35 countries. And yet they've taken upon themselves the task of setting the rules of the game for international tax cooperation and for international tax matters more generally. And that's quite an extraordinary power to have. And we just want to flag up this question. Why do they have this power? What's their legitimacy in this area? I can answer that one, or I'll give you my opinion on that if you wish, but I'll move on to Pascal Saint-Amand and the question you asked. Pascal And his team are currently engaged by the G20 countries, the finance ministers of the G20 countries, to produce a standard, a global standard for automatic information exchange, which is regarded as the most effective way of tackling cross-border tax evasion. We've been saying for a very long time that actually it should be the United Nations Tax Committee which has the power to produce such standards, because that committee is representative of United Nations countries, or rather it should be. And United Nations countries are obviously broader than OECD countries, and that all countries in the world are members of the United Nations. That would make it more legitimate, and any standard would therefore be more representative of the interests of non-OECD countries. And let me say as an aside, most of the tax havens of the world are very closely associated to the OECD countries. So we see the OECD as having a long track record of protecting the interests of their member states and of the tax havens related to member states. British tax havens, Swiss tax havens, obviously, and American tax havens are all represented by the OECD, and their standard setting has generally been very, very poor. Mr. Santamon's assertion that developing countries are not interested in automatic information exchange flies in the face of my own discussions with officials from developing countries, particularly Africa, but also Latin American and Asian countries, who for many years have been saying, well, actually, we would like to have automatic information exchange. We don't want it to be too cumbersome. We don't want it to be too expensive. But we see this as a crucial way, a crucial tool for tackling the tax evasion and corruption by our elites. And this hints at the problem here, because if you talk to the political and business elites in many countries, not just developing countries, but also developed countries, they're not particularly interested in tackling tax evasion because they are themselves guilty of it. And the last thing they want is our effective tools for tackling tax evasion. So it depends who you talk to. If you talk to some politicians in any country, they'll say, oh, yes, we're in favor of automatic information exchange. Others will say, no, we're not in favor of it. It's a divided picture, but by and large, regrettably, the powerful elites that control many countries are not in favor of automatic information exchange because they, their families, their sponsors, their funding organizations, etc., are all engaged in cross-border tax evasion. And for the same reason that turkeys don't generally vote for Christmas, they're not likely to support automatic information exchange because they know it's likely to be much more effective in tackling tax evasion and the use of tax havens.
Specifically in response to the Santamon comment, you all produced a report which showed overwhelming support amongst these nations, the various developing nations, as you said, of Africa, Latin America, etc., that they had interest in it, but that they supported it.
Well, I wouldn't use the word overwhelming. I think I need to be a little bit nuanced here, because for one reason or another, we didn't have an overwhelming response to our questionnaire. And one of the reasons that we didn't have an overwhelming response to our questionnaire was because the OECD's global forum was at the time also issuing their own questionnaire. And they sent out, apparently, they sent out a message to the countries they were in contact with, saying, well, we don't want to overburden you, so we suggest you don't reply to the TJN questionnaire. They didn't support us. Now, what's interesting here is the person who headed that global forum questionnaire and the relevant section of the global forum is a person called Colin Powell, who not the Colin Powell.
Ah, okay.
Not him. No. Colin Powell was my former boss in Jersey. He was the chief advisor to the government of Jersey, the architect of Jersey's tax haven, currently the international ambassador for Jersey's tax haven work. It does raise the question, what on earth is a person like that doing in such an influential role within the OECD's global forum process? And why are they trying to block our questionnaire? But anyway, that's an aside. But I think it's fairly typical of the OECD. It almost epitomizes the problems that I have with the OECD, that you find that tax havens have managed to embed their senior people right at the heart of the OECD processes time and time and time again.
Very interesting.
And Pascal Santamos, whilst I think that he is a perfect man of perfect integrity and honour, I think he genuinely wants to take action. The fact that he's working within the OECD, which, as I explained earlier, has interests, special interests in this area, and has shown in the past that it's very unwilling to take action against tax havens because so many of its member states are politically and economically very closely tied to the world's leading tax havens. The fact that they've allowed basically the fox to take over control of the chicken coop tells you why I regard the OECD and my tax justice network generally regards the OECD as not suited to this process. Now, in our report, which you can download from our website, we looked at the interests of developing country officials, and the report pretty much concurred with what we had anecdotally, and the report was based on the survey that we did, the postal survey. It confirmed what we'd heard anecdotally from many developing country officials, which is, yes, they do want to have automatic information exchange. They don't want it to immediately require reciprocity of treatment. They are concerned that they need to have help to build their capacity to handle the amount of data involved. But by and large, they regard automatic information exchange as the most effective tool to tackle cross-border tax evasion.
Sure, but most of these countries, they don't have the infrastructure to immediately produce the data, if you will. And that's one argument, if I'm not mistaken, that against this mutual, this OECD model that would require a reciprocity. If I request information from Switzerland and I am, say, Mozambique, I would also have to produce the equivalent information. And if I don't have the infrastructure, if I don't have the tax information is a huge amount of data, and if I don't have computer databases trained experts to sift through that data, then I'm out on the loop.
Right, that is the argument put forward by many people. Look, at a practical level, down here on planet Earth, I would make a number of comments. Comment number one, the very fact that the OECD and others say there is a huge amount of data involved confirms there is a huge amount of cross-border tax evasion going on. If we were just talking about a handful of people, then there wouldn't be a huge amount of data, but we're talking about thousands of people, in fact, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions globally. But take a country like Nigeria, we'd be talking about potentially tens of thousands of offshore accounts held by Nigerian citizens. It is a huge amount of data. So it's confirmation of the fact that we have a major problem on our hand, which is impacting negatively upon their development processes. How to handle that huge amount of data? Well, first of all, it doesn't need to be such a huge amount of data. The data, which could be securely encrypted and shared automatically, could just be name, passport number, place of residence. This person has an account at the following bank. In fact, if it's on an Excel spreadsheet, it could be no more than 10 fields per person. All that's required is something to trigger off an investigation by the tax authorities in the country concerned.
Hmm.
Now, the second point I would make is that whilst there are probably many Nigerians with offshore accounts in Switzerland, it's very hard to conceive that there are many Swiss people with offshore accounts in Nigeria. So this issue of reciprocity is a curious demand right from the word go. We're in favour of reciprocity, but we say it needs to be developing countries or non-OECD countries need to be given time, maybe 3 to 5 years, to build the system so that they can engage in reciprocity. But to begin with, surely it's much more important that Nigerian tax authorities have access to information about Nigerian citizens with offshore accounts in Switzerland than the other way around, because it's reasonable to assume that there aren't many Swiss people who have offshore accounts in Lagos. It's a fair argument. The third thing is, and again, this is a practical matter. I don't know how much you travel through developing into Africa and Asia, but your first encounter, in almost every single case, your first encounter with those countries will involve automatic information exchange, because on arrival at the border, you will hand over your passport, and your passport will be swiped using advanced American technology. And the border control officers will have access to your Interpol records. That is automatic information exchange. The idea that it's technically beyond the capacity of developing countries to handle automatic information exchange is patronizing and condescending. And we've said that publicly to ministers here in Britain and elsewhere who've made that argument. Actually, they can handle the technologies perfectly well. One of my problems is that the OECD has singularly failed to simplify the technical needs. Above all, they failed to arrive at a protocol for what's called a taxpayer identification number, a TIN, so that we have a global TIN, taxpayer identification number, which would facilitate automatic information exchange. Interestingly, where there's political will to arrive at a global protocol, as is the case with passports, it was done immediately. In other words, when the Americans wanted to have a global protocol for unique passport numbers, which would allow for the border control systems to be used that I referred to, then within a matter of months, they'd arrived at the necessary protocols. It all boils down to political will, or sure. In the case of tax evasion, the lack of political will to do anything serious about it. And this, is, I'm afraid, is boils down to nothing else than power. The rich and the powerful are the tax, by and large, the tax evaders, and they are protecting their interests here.
Well, and I suppose the real mafia doesn't have as deep pockets as the pinstripe mafia.
Correct. Absolutely.
So before we get into the financial...
yeah, that's dead right.
Before we get into the financial secrecy index, I was just going to ask where this $20 to $30 trillion number comes from.
Okay.
So money that is not in jurisdictions where it belongs, that is sifting out.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, if you Google the price of offshore, just Google that, it will take you to the relevant documents, which will include the methodology. The price of offshore is a report which published estimates produced for us by a New York-based, very specialist organization called the Sag Harbor Group. And they've specialized in tracking offshore wealth. They've been doing this since the 1970s. Specifically, Jim Henry, an economist who used to work with McKinsey, he has been researching these estimates for many years. And at the beginning of 2011, in January 2011, I went to New York and I commissioned Jim to update figures we'd initially produced in 2005. And the reason I wanted them updated was because we had a sense that after 2005, there was an acceleration of private wealth moving offshore, particularly after the financial crash. And we also knew that our original estimates from 2005 had some very, very major gaps and was therefore a massive underestimation. So I commissioned Jim because I thought that he would give us a closer estimate. But I said, produce a range, a low-end range, which he came out at $21 trillion, and a top-end range, $32 trillion, just for financial assets held offshore.
Wow.
If you look up the price of offshore, as I said, the whole report will give you a detailed explanation of the methodology. We didn't just use one single estimate. We commissioned Jim to triangulate, in other words, use three different, in fact, he used more, but at least three different methods for estimation. He also did an extensive semi-structured interviewing amongst banks and financial professionals.
And the banks disclosed? Are these the big sort of the Wall Street London banks? Or?
Well, the banks, obviously the banks disclose a certain amount of information which is available from their records. As far as the semi-structured interview processes were concerned, some were happy off the record to participate, others weren't, as I understand it. Many bankers were quite happy to participate off the record. Obviously, you get some limited information from the Bank of International Settlements. Unfortunately, the Bank for International Settlements does not disclose all of the information that it has available to it, which meant that, means that, as Jim Henry describes it, very often we're engaged in an exercise in night vision. We're basically stumbling around in the dark. My own view, by the way, is the real volume of wealth held offshore is considerably higher. Particularly since we are only looking at financial assets, we weren't looking at non-financial assets, and an astonishing amount of non-financial assets, including real estate, jets, cars,
expensive paintings
and other works of art, etc., all owned through offshore financial structures, offshore structures. So my view is that Jim Henry's estimate is an underestimate. I mean, even on the financial side, it doesn't include large bills in circulation. And by large bills, I'm not talking about $50 bills. I'm talking about the $100 bills and the 500 euro notes, huge amounts, hundreds of billions of which, not trillions, are strangely out there in circulation, but are not being used regularly in the shops. So what are they being used for?
Oh, maybe paying the barber?
Yeah. And I always pay my barber with a 500 euro note. Now, seriously, there is an issue here because the sums involved are colossal. But it does raise a question about why are these notes being issued and what purpose do they serve? Because if you went into most shops with a 500 euro note, they probably wouldn't accept it.
No, they probably don't have that amount of money on site.
Yep.
Switching gears, what is the financial secrecy index, and what is financial secrecy, or what is financial transparency?
Okay. Here we are looking in particular at laws, regulations, and behaviors by different jurisdictions relating to the provision of some kind or other of financial secrecy. And financial secrecy can be provided in all sorts of ways. The most obvious one, of course, is banking secrecy. But there are many other ways of arriving at similar forms of secrecy. For example, some jurisdictions don't have banking secrecy laws, that is, laws which make it a crime to reveal account information from a particular bank, but they do have effective codes which, for example, do not require banks to collect all the information that might be needed to meet automatic information exchange provisions. And by doing that, effectively, they are providing a veil of secrecy, because if you don't have the information needed to make automatic information exchange practicable, then to all intents and purposes, you have banking secrecy. You can't share information because you're not obtaining the information, then you're effectively a secrecy, providing a secrecy service. So the secrecy index is an attempt to look at the way in which jurisdictions around the world provide a veil of secrecy which might enable criminal activity, including tax evasion. It looks at company registration details, whether or not there's a requirement to register ownership information, real ownership information. It looks at the way in which some jurisdictions provide facilities for trusts, which are very used in very secretive ways, or foundations, or Anstalt. It looks at the provisions for requiring companies to report annually and what they are reporting annually. It looks at their track record compliance with international anti-money laundering requirements, etc., etc. And what it does is it attempts to rank these countries, not only in terms of how secretive they are, and it does that by awarding each country a secrecy score based upon these very objective criteria, but it also uses a scale weight to give some idea of how large an offshore financial sector this country has. And the reason it does that is because in the past, much discussion about tax havens has tended to focus on the obscure little islands in the middle of the Caribbean, or in the Pacific. And it hasn't looked at the big players. And we wanted to draw attention to the role of the big players: the United States, United Kingdom, Germany, Switzerland, because these are the really big operators here. And so we used IMF data, trade data on share of the global market for offshore financial services to arrive at a scale weight. And by marrying the two, that is, by marrying the secrecy score to the scale weight, we arrive at a ranking. And what this ranking has achieved is it's shifted attention away from the small islands in the sun towards the role of the really, really big players, that is, United States, United Kingdom, Luxembourg, Switzerland, and put them into the forefront. Needless to say, they don't like it at all, but I think in the real world, most people who know about this subject would accept that actually our index more accurately describes what's happening and how it's happening.
Sure, they might accept it, but it is a little surprising, even to myself, to see the U.S. as number six, Germany as number eight. I guess your prior discussion explained a lot of the reason. I'm guessing a lot of the reason is the scale. These are just very large economies, and even if their secrecy is nowhere near that of the Cayman Islands or Bermuda, it's I guess you would need a lot of it in order to get pretty high on the list. Is that how they get there? To tie another question to that, is the United States and Germany where a lot of this $27 trillion are housed?
Yes, the United States is a particularly big player. I mean, the biggest player of all, of course, is the United Kingdom. Because if you look at the world of tax havens, you'll see a very, very large number of small islands which fly the Union flag, because they're British. And that's not coincidence. It's because the British, in my opinion, since 1956 was the at the end of the empire, but it was also when the British, when the City of London launched, effectively launched the euro market, or the euro dollar market, or the euro bond market. In other words, when the first major offshore, post-war offshore economy, offshore market was launched in 56, the British effectively started to carve out a really important advantage for the City of London by making the City of London an offshore financial centre. But in the case of the US, amongst experts, it's long been known that Nevada, Wyoming, Delaware, Florida, Texas, and various other states are actually pretty Wild West territories when it comes to registering companies, registering offshore vehicles of one kind or another. And I could give you one anecdote after another, particularly from discussions I've had with company formation agents.
Well, give us one, maybe.
In Nevada. Well, I'm interesting. Traveling through the states quite a few years ago, I met this guy, and I was talking about Nevada, and he said, no, Nevada is for amateurs. He said, if you really, really want to go to get down and dirty and be very secretive, come to Wyoming. So I looked at his website, which was, frankly, extraordinarily open in saying what you can and cannot do. But for less than $100, I could register a company in Wyoming, no questions asked, no passport details, nothing whatsoever, no reporting requirements whatsoever, and do whatever I wished to with that company, and then kill it off. And there'd be no record at any level of what that company was for and who sat behind it. That's what I mean by real Wild West territory.
Sounds like a good deal.
Very good deal. About the best deal you can get in the world, as far as I'm concerned, because even the Seychelles charges more than that.
So is secrecy correlated with inequality? There's been a lot of talk of late on inequality, income, and even wealth because of Piketty's book.
I think, first of all, I'd like to make a general point about Gini coefficients, which, as you know, are the generally agreed and used measure of income and wealth inequality.
Yes.
When we published, I don't know if you've seen this, I'll just get a copy of it up for you. We published a newsletter called Tax Justice Focus, and we published one in June 2012, I think, on inequality. And amongst others, Piketty was a contributor. Here it is, I'll just get you a link to it.
We'll put it up on the site.
You got it. Sorry?
I will put it up on the site.
Okay, well, here it is. Here's the link. The first point we made in the opening article was that Gini coefficients massively underestimate the true scale of inequality around the world. And that's because across the board, every measure discounts or excludes the wealth of the very, very, of the ultra wealthy elites, the ultra high net wealth individuals and high net wealth individuals. There's a distinction between the two. So both high net wealth individuals and ultra high net wealth individuals are excluded, and all offshore wealth is excluded. So that 32 trillion we were discussing there doesn't even figure. So the situation, as we argue in the opening article, is actually much, much worse.
And in many ways, it's very difficult.
The matter is,
go ahead.
We have no idea about, and the general public has no idea how unequal the world has become, because the really wealthy people, the 0.1%, have actually hidden most of their wealth offshore. But the outcome of this is simple. If we don't tax wealth, and by and large wealth is no longer taxed, and if the ultra-high income earners are not being taxed, who is being taxed? Well, actually, it's lower-income people and the poor. Because if you look at the trend over the last 40 years, it's been to cut taxes on wealth and income, increase taxes on labor, and increase taxes on consumption through VAT, for example. all of which has been incredibly regressive and has, in almost every country around the world, has deepened inequality.
Sure, it's now the largest tax source in Germany.
The VAT?
Yes.
Yeah. And, that's, and I think this is what I find very regrettable. It's increasingly being realized amongst economists, though I and other economists have been saying this for many years, that the result of this is to slow down economic growth, because it's not the ultra-high net wealth individuals who are going to spend, create sufficient demand to spend us out of recession. VATs are particularly regressive in terms of their impact upon the poorest households. So it's affecting both poverty and inequality, but it's also negatively shaping the way in which development occurs.
It's a definitely a serious problem. A moment ago, I was just going to mention, just in passing, that people like Emmanuel Saez, and others have said that it's just mentioned how difficult it is to get their hands on actual information about the wealth of the richest, and so that in many cases they don't actually respond to surveys and these sort of things. They actually rely on things like Forbes.
yep. But I think, I mean, Saez co-authored the article in this edition of Tax Justice Focus. By the way, have you got the link there?
Yes, I got the link.
Okay. If you look at their article, and they've been saying this for a very long time, the trouble with using Forbes and other rich surveys is that, first of all, the really rich do not disclose how much of their, what the true extent of their wealth, because in practice, they tend to hold their wealth using very sophisticated legal structures, including trusts. And they can, in the case of a trust, they can legitimately say, well, we don't actually own that wealth. We might benefit from it, but it belongs to the trust.
Sure, so that Hillary Clinton can say that as they went out of the White House, they were almost broke.
Yeah. It's a very specious argument. But the end result is, and the World Bank have confirmed this, we've had quite a few discussions with senior World Bank officials about this, is that we have a very restricted understanding of how much wealth is out there. And it's massively underestimated in the case of ultra-high net wealth individuals. And I think Forbes massively underestimates it as well.
So what is the future for information sharing with the outcasts or outlook for the OECD thing not being so bright? Is there anything remotely positive on the plate to look forward to?
Yeah, I'm actually quite optimistic. I think that the OECD will, bit by bit, gradually, we'll see the emergence of an effective automatic information standard for exchange. I think that demand is rising. I think politically the mood is shifting. Within Africa, there's a shifting focus away from corruption by officials to also look at the offshore dimension of corruption, the extensive embezzlement and fraud, which leads to money going offshore, the huge tax evasion. So pressure is mounting from many countries around the world for automatic information exchange. I think it's just a matter of time, and the OECD will come up with some kind of standard, and gradually I expect over the next 10 years that standard will be enhanced and a real gold standard will emerge from it.
Excellent.
So I'm relatively optimistic. I mean, I think obviously we've seen the preview, the draft that of the document that the OECD will be providing to G20 later this year. It doesn't go as far as we wish. We are critical of it, but there are still some areas where we think that progress is being made, and we also think that pressure within the European Union to update their savings tax directive is also leading to a gradual improvement of their automatic information exchange processes. And of course, we have FATCA as well. So it is now emerging in one form or another as the global standard, and that's progress.
Well, one says that the road to heaven leads through Sinai. Speaking of information sharing, how do you get your information out? You mentioned your newsletter. And could you tell us a little bit about the TaxCast and where the idea came from and who's behind it?
Right. You probably know that Tax Justice Network, as I said earlier, is a global network. We don't actually have offices anywhere. We work virtually. So most of the way in which we disseminate information is through through some one form of social media or another, whether it's our website or our blog or the TaxCast or Twitter. We get information out. We regularly commission expert reports, which we publish. And when we publish those reports, we put them out to journalists. Now, there are a lot of journalists who are very interested in this subject. So we tend to have a lot of journalists who are interested in and who will report on our stories. We generally have a good reputation for the accuracy of our information and also for the balance of our analysis and commentary. But we also give quite colourful quotes, which always helps journalists. Can I also add, by the way, that one of our big programs is to train journalists in illicit financial flows. We run a training course with the Centre for Investigative Journalism here in London. And that's massively increased the interest of journalists in this whole subject. So journalists play a key part. The TaxCast was conceived by the current producer, a former BBC producer called Naomi Fowler. The idea is simple, to produce a 20-minute monthly podcast, which can be provided free of charge to radio stations around the world and can be downloaded free of charge as a podcast. We wanted to do several things, but above all, we wanted to overcome the idea that tax is necessarily an incredibly dull technocratic subject. So we wanted to have an approach which is easily understandable, which is reasonably colourful, looks at the issues at an international as well as national level, and which is topical. And I think by and large, Naomi has been very successful in achieving that. The global coverage is quite extraordinary. In the last 24 months, we've seen a huge pickup in listenership. The downloads are well above average for most programs, but the number of radio stations, largely local commercial radio stations that have picked up on the TaxCast and broadcast it, it has been really quite unexpectedly large. So a success story. In the case of some of our longer investigations, we will work with a particular journalist. We'll select a journalist and work with that journalist for maybe many months to develop the story, to investigate the story, to check the story, validate it, all its sources and so on, and then assist with this publication. So that, you know, we use a variety of different media and we work with the media in a variety of different ways.
Great. Well, about the colorful language that you all produce, I was convinced by Prem Sika that the accountants were the gods chosen because they were the responsible for chaos, and without chaos, there would be nothing else.
Well, Prem's one of my great mentors. He's a great friend, and he is regularly kind of repeating to me that our task is to make the familiar unfamiliar. And in that respect, I think we are quite successful because we're challenging a very strongly developed orthodoxy and trying to turn it on its head. And the only way you can do that is by adopting a very different language.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
So in closing, what is next on the organization's agenda?
Oh, good questions. Yeah, that's a very good question. Right. Well, we already launched mid-year in 2013. We had a round table of our entire team. The only time our entire team has ever met was in early July last year. They met around the table here to discuss our next steps. We knew that we'd already moved a long way forward on automatic information exchange, on country-by-country reporting, on public requiring public disclosure of company ownership information. In other words, many of the key asks that we laid out when we launched in 2003 were on the G20 agenda. So what next? Well, the next thing to do as far as we're concerned is to broaden ourselves, our focus thematically, and engage with new communities. All we can do is to open up thematic discussions and hope that related organizations will pick up on that. So, for example, we recently, early July, held a colloquium at McGill University in Canada to talk about tax justice and human rights, and to open up a human rights dimension to the whole tax justice issue. When you stop and think about it for longer than 10 seconds, you'll see it's a bit of a no-brainer issue. Of course, there's a human rights dimension to tax rights, because you cannot deliver on human rights commitments to education or to shelter or to security or to improve water or whatever without a great deal of financial resource, and that comes largely from tax. At the same time, if a company is avoiding tax, it is depriving citizens of their human rights. And if a country like Switzerland is using its laws to undermine the tax regimes of other countries, then it is deliberately depriving them, purposefully, knowingly, and deliberately depriving those countries of their tax regimes and their ability to meet their human rights. So we want to open up a human rights dimension to this. And we want to bring big organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and others to engage on these issues. We also want to engage, we want to open up a global discussion about the whole issue of what we call tax wars and others call tax competition. We think that tax competition is, in economic terms, a complete nonsense. It's more accurately described as tax wars. It's using your tax regime to undermine the tax regimes of other countries. It's the race to the bottom. And I always point out that the bottom is not zero. The bottom is negative tax territory, because there is no end to the ability of capital to extract subsidies of one kind or another. So it doesn't end with companies paying no tax. It ends with companies receiving massive subsidies and subventions of one kind or another to invest in a country. That is not capitalism. That is something else entirely, and that is the reality of the current world.
Having grown up in the southern U.S. Or spent a long time there at least, I am well aware of that form of whatever you call it, neo-feudalism. There is always a great rejoicing and celebration in the local newspaper when, say, Mercedes or Airbus or some other big company opens up a factory that, you know, employs maybe at most 5,000, but more likely 3,000 or less people. And, you know, they get huge tax breaks, upwards of billions, you know, in a state that, you know, is one of the biggest recipients of federal money, so they get more than they pay out in taxes.
That's absolutely. I mean, there are many cases. In fact, one of my colleagues in the network, a guy called Greg Leroy, who's with the U.S. not-for-profit called I can't remember what it's called, but anyway, I mean, Greg's investigated many instances of exactly that kind of corporate subsidy in the kind of race to the bottom between states in the United States.
Is it good jobs first?
It is good jobs first. You're dead right. Well done.
I looked him up.
Well, Greg's, I've got a couple of his books here on my shelf, and he's a very, 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 very good researcher, and it's a good, really excellent organization. They've done a good job there. But we see similar happening in Brazil. In fact, in many federated states, you see similar processes, and it's happening within Europe as well. But as I say, the race to the bottom takes you into negative territory. Those are two of our key areas. I mean, we're also seeing some really interesting things like the development of a women for tax justice movement, which I think will help to explore in different countries the gender dimensions of tax policies and of tax injustices. In other words, we're beginning to see a really exciting widening and deepening of the tax justice debate.
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah. What's not to like?
Well, people always say that accountancy and these sort of things and taxes, it's boring. It's, you have this stereotypical image of your father on the week before tax day sitting in front of the calculator crunching numbers and with a Tylenol bottle of aspirin or something, and it doesn't have a good rep, like the civil rights struggle, these sort of things. But I guess it seems to be, from what you're telling me, to be getting to the point where people are starting to understand that these things are inextricably intertwined, things like human and civil rights and the ability for a country to elicit the amount, the monies required to basically finance roads and schools and electricity and so on.
Yeah, I'd go beyond that. I'm going to make two extraordinary assertions. Assertion number one is that tax is the lifeblood of democracy. You cannot run a democracy without tax. Or rather, the democracy you might run without tax would be a pretty hollow democracy, because a democracy which doesn't have the resources to fulfill health and education and other service needs and to secure the, provide proper security services, police and likewise border controls and so on, all of that costs a great deal of money. Now, there are lots of ways in which the governments could raise that money. It could raise it through debt, a very expensive way of doing it, or it could raise it through simply printing money, which tends to be inflationary, or it could raise it through fair tax policies and progressive taxation. More importantly, taxes kind of bind citizens and state together, because when you pay taxes, you're going to be more interested in how your money is being spent. And I'm not the first person to observe that states which don't rely upon a general broad taxation base but tend to rely upon oil and tax revenues, generally speaking, tend to be more autocratic states. Think about the oil principalities and the Emirates and in the Middle East and Saudi Arabia and all the corrupted oil states of North Africa and West Africa. They generally speaking are not democracies. In other words, tax is a fundamental part of democratic state building. That's my first assertion. Secondly, and even more extraordinary, I'd say that tax is one of the most extraordinary social inventions that humankind has come up with. It's the way in which we all get together to pool resources to provide ourselves with roads and security services and fresh water and all the rest of it. And as an invention, it's an extraordinary invention.